This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
He has put all the USA in jeopardy. He's already lost defensive cut budget support. Defensive cut their aid. The U.S. might eventually cut its aid. U.S. probably will cut security assistance.
That was Michael Sherkin, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council on Niger's coup. Details coming up. Also, envoys from the West African bloc ECOWAS are expected in Niger today. And Ivory Coast's former president, Henri Konan Bedi, has died at age 89. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. Envoys from the West African bloc, ECOWAS, are expected in Niger today, a week after a coup that triggered alarm among neighbors and allies. Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, leaders on Sunday imposed trade and financial sanctions and gave the coup leaders a week to reinstate Niger's democratically elected president, Mohamed Bazoum, or face potential use of force. A delegation led by former Nigerian President Abdul Salim Abubakar is scheduled to fly to Niamey today, a senior source in ECOWAS and a Nigerian military official told the French news agency AFP. ECOWAS military chiefs are also expected to start a three-day meeting in the Nigerian capital Abuja. Nigeria's chief of staff, Christopher Musa, said in an interview on RFI Hausa on Monday that we are ready and as soon as we receive the order to intervene, we will do so. But junta-ruled Mali and Burkina Faso warned that any military intervention in their neighbor would be tantamount to a declaration of war against them. Military chiefs from the West African bloc, ECOWAS, are holding talks in Nigeria Wednesday about last week's coup in Niger. Earlier this week, the regional economic bloc set a deadline for junta leaders to restore ousted President Mohamed Bazoum or face a possible military intervention. The warning prompted a sharp counter-warning from two of Niger's neighbors who have leaders that came to power in coups. VOA's Nairobi bureau chief, Mariama Diallo, reports from Kenya on the heightened tensions in the Sahel region.
With 4 days left until a deadline to return power to Niger's democratically elected president, Mohamed Bazoum, and Niger's neighbors, Mali and Burkina Faso, warning against any military intervention, tensions couldn't be higher in the Sahel this week. Nasiru Seydou is the head of the Voice of the Voiceless, a human rights organization. Speaking to VOA from Niger's capital, Niamey, he says he doesn't think ECOWAS will intervene militarily because they didn't do it in Burkina Faso or Mali during recent coups.
C'est le dialogue qui devrait être privilégié.
He says dialogue should take center stage in situations like these. The security concerns the new coup leaders gave as reasons in the zones of Tillaberi, Diffa, and other places where they believe the Bazoum government has not been very effective. That's the reason, he says, why the military in Burkina Faso and Mali are also convinced that the security situation in the Liptako-Gourma could only be improved with the combined efforts of those three armies. The Liptako-Gourma is an area in the central Sahel region that falls in eastern Burkina Faso, southwestern Niger, and a portion of southeast central Mali. In 2021, the Food and Agricultural Organization, FAO, sounded the alarm about a crisis there caused by increasing competition for resources, climatic disruption, high levels of poverty, and violence caused by organized crime networks and non-state armed groups. But given tensions with Niger's current partners like France and the United States, Seydou says the new military leaders might turn to other powers for help in that region. With the high tensions between Niger and France, between the military and the French presidency, the situation is not favorable for continued relations, he says, especially when it comes to France and its allies helping Niger get out of the situation. So, he adds, the Niger military doesn't have a choice but look elsewhere. France and the European Union suspended aid to Niger after last week's coup. France, whose embassy was attacked recently by coup supporters, has started evacuating some of its citizens and the citizens of other nations out of Niger. ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, also imposed sanctions. But Guinea, whose leader, Mamadi Doumbouya, recently came to power through a coup, denounced that measure. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said he spoke to Niger's President Bazoum late Tuesday and reiterated the United States and its partners' support for democratic governance. The U.S. recently granted $504 million to finance an infrastructure regional project connecting Niamey and the Benin port city of Cotonou. That, along with other projects, could be affected, says Michael Shurkin, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and the director of global programs at 14 North Strategies, an Africa-focused business advisory group.
The truth remains that Tiani, right, the coup leader, is putting all of this in jeopardy. He has put all the USAID in jeopardy. He's already lost the French have cut budget support. The French have cut their aid. The U.S. might eventually cut its aid. U.S. probably will cut security assistance.
While some say the international community's responses to the coup are highly appropriate, Shurkin says the cutoff in aid might have other consequences.
6 months from now, if the French have cut off the aid, the Americans are packing up, the EU's packing up. Realistically, and the economy's tanking, I see the Nigerian leader will play populist politics, will step up the anti-French rhetoric, and will reach out to the Russians. This all seems very plausible to me.
For now, all eyes are on Niger as the deadline to return power to Bazoum draws near. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
Much attention has been given to fighting in Sudan's capital Khartoum and its troubled Darfur region. However, the Kordofan area on the border with South Sudan has also been seeing intense clashes. Thousands of people in the area have fled to South Sudan as fatalities due to the conflict increases. Henry Wilkins looks at this new front in this report from Rank South Sudan.
Like thousands of others, Mohammed Hamdan Mohammed has just arrived in South Sudan from El Abeid in North Kordofan. He says that since Sudan's war started in mid-April, fighting between the Sudanese military and paramilitary rapid support forces, the RSF has intensified. Mohammed says he came to South Sudan out of fear for his safety, fear for his life. He says that friends in Sudan were killed, which he saw with his own eyes when the government and the RSF were fighting. He adds that some were able to flee, but others were injured or killed. Video taken from social media purports to show people taking cover from crossfire in Kordofan. The fighting in Kordofan is partly what triggered the mass displacement seen here. The Sudanese armed forces, the SAF, have accused rebels from the Sudan People's Liberation Movement North, or SPLMN, of breaking a ceasefire and attacking their troops throughout June and July. The SPLMN is a group of ethnically Nuba people active in Kordofan since the 1980s. According to experts, the SPLMN has long-standing grievances with the mostly ethnically Arab Sudanese government and is taking advantage of the breakdown of law and order caused by the war in Sudan. The rebel group's stated aim is to secure more political representation for the Nuba people. Samer Salman is president of the U.S. Educated Sudanese Association.
There have long been ethnic tensions between Khartoum, center of government, and the people of the Nuba Mountains who have long been marginalized. We're really at a tipping point where we may see South Kordofan being dragged into the war.
The fighting between the SAF and SPLMN only accounts for one aspect of the fighting in Kordofan, however. Data from the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project, a non-profit that remotely monitors global conflict, shows there have been 485 fatalities in Kordofan due to conflict since Sudan's war started in April. In the same period before the conflict, there were just 30. An increase of more than 15 times. The data also reveals that approximately 80% of the fatalities can be linked to clashes between the paramilitary RSF and the SAF, which this video from social media purports to show. Asked what the RSF is trying to achieve in Kordofan, one expert said, it's not clear. Eric Reeves is a Sudan expert and professor emeritus at Smith College in the US.
That's a good question. Political ambitions in Darfur are clear. This is where land has been promised to RSF recruits from other places in West Africa, Niger, Mali. It may be that some of this land has already been promised to RSF fighters, as it's been promised to them in Darfur.
But what is clear is that average citizens are being forced to flee the area in the thousands. In July, the United Nations said around 8,000 people have been displaced internally in Kordofan. There is no data on how many have fled to South Sudan. Jamisco Fela has just arrived in South Sudan from Kordofan. He says he witnessed 16 people from South Sudan's Dinka tribe killed in Kordofan, adding that they were killed in crossfire by government forces. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Renk, South Sudan.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. More than 700 young African leaders are networking with several U.S. policy and business leaders in Washington during the U.S.-sponsored three-day Mandela Washington Summit. Among the African leaders in attendance is Gail Motlong, a South African alumnus of the Mandela Washington Fellowship and the founder of Girl with a Purpose Foundation, a non-governmental organization focused on empowering girls and women on the continent. VOA's Mike Hovey sat down with Motlong to discuss the importance of networking summit and how the Mandela Washington Fellowship is impacting Africa.
I run an organization, I empower young people, so we are very much big on education and giving, which is, you know, community outreaches.
Now, you talked about the fact that Yali taught you resilience. What has your experience been like in terms of implementing those lessons?
It has impacted me as an individual so much, speaking about resilience. Because after the Mandela Washington Fellowship, it's not the end. That's actually the beginning of more things.
Right.
So there are many activities that are offered. You know, there will be grants that are offered to alumni who would apply for them, maybe to implement a project. For me personally, I remember I applied for the Link Grant. And after being part of the Mandela Washington Fellowship, I met quite amazing young leaders. One of them was a good friend of mine from Kenya. She lives with disability. However, her life, the way she does things, making an impact in her community, challenged me so much, and I fell in love with her. I fell in love with her work. And I said, you know, how many young people in South Africa who are facing so many challenges because of being disabled? Mm-hmm. So after receiving a grant, I decided to do a project to empower people with disability. And for me, I think it gave me a different outlook, you know, and the importance of inclusion, which when I observe in my country, that still we still have a long way to go mm-hmm. when it comes mm-hmm. to that, because a lot of people with disabilities feel neglected.
Right. So now talk to me a little more about your work.
We do a whole lot of things. Like I said, we are big on education and giving. One of the things I learned from the Mandela Washington is servant leadership, which is something that Mandela always spoke about, you know, that the greatest of them all is the one who serves. Mm-hmm. So we teach them servant leadership. We teach them, you know, about skills development. We also developed a program within Girl with a Purpose called Boardroom Talks with the Boys.
Okay.
We saw that there was a gap, you know, because the girl, everything was focused on the girl child, mm-hmm. take a girl child to work, girl this, girl that, and there's nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. But we see that now there is an imbalance.
Right.
So now we decided to bring in a program that empowers the boys and also teach them that when you see a woman who is powerful, that is not a way to feel intimidated, mm-hmm. but to see it as somebody that can help you build your vision. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of GBV in my country, mm-hmm. it's also influenced by that because mm-hmm. men feel intimidated.
To what extent are you addressing, I guess, the challenges faced by the girl child? You were talking about equity, equality.
Yeah. So I remember I had a conversation back then with a friend of mine, and I was telling her about the work that I'm doing, what I'm trying to do with the boys. And she said something interesting. She said, you know what, Gail, one thing I've noticed in our country and maybe around the world is that men, I'm not worried that my son is going to struggle because, you know, men, everything, you know, opportunities are always there. Engineering, they consider men. Big positions, they consider men, even though a woman qualifies for it, you know. So it makes it even tricky whereby, you know, there are some women who would feel inferior at first. But now we are seeing women who are rising to say, I can take up that space. You know, when we are at an early stage where it's a boy child, we are empowering the girl and then the boy child is here. Mm-hmm. So when we speak and address these issues, it's going to make it easy to say, hey, yes, the boy child feels neglected. However, moving forward, when they're now adults, men are given more opportunities than women, yet women are capable. What can be done? Because it's all about giving people a fair chance.
That was Gail Motlong, an alumnus of the Mandela Washington Fellowship and the founder of Girl with a Purpose. She spoke with VOA's Mike Hovey from the Mandela Washington Summit. Ivory Coast's nationalist former president, Henri Konan Bedi, who had not excluded the possibility of a return to power even in his latter days, has died. He was 89. Bedi was the chosen successor to Ivory Coast's founding father, Félix Houphouët-Boigny, who ruled over the West African nation from independence from France in 1960 until his death in 1993. Bédé served as president from 1993 until 1999, when he was overthrown by the military in the country's first ever coup. He tried unsuccessfully to return as president in 2000, 2010, and 2020. The French news agency AFP says Bedi's main influence on national politics had been to promote Ivorite or Ivorianness, the notion of a national identity and national economy in a country with dozens of ethnic groups. The nationalist policy discriminated against immigrants in favor of people with two Ivorian parents, affecting countless workers on the country's cocoa plantations. Bedi told journalists ahead of the October 2020 elections that for his party, the Ivory Coast Democratic Party African Democratic Rally, age is an asset. Age unites experience and also competence. Bedi came in third with 1.7% of the vote. A grand jury has indicted former U.S. President Donald Trump on a number of alleged crimes in the effort to overturn Joe Biden's election victory, which was the backdrop to the riot at the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. Special Counsel Jack Smith called the attack on the Capitol an unprecedented assault on the seat of American democracy and said it was fueled by lies. Criminal defense lawyer and former CIA officer Jack Rice describes to VOA's Carol Van Dam the significance of the four-count indictment and how it impacts the 2024 presidential race, in which Trump is still the Republican Party frontrunner.
It's about the question, can a sitting president use his governmental power to overturn the will of the people? I mean, that really is what this is about. And it's actually a fundamental and really critical question. We've been waiting for more than two and a half years really on this now. But as importantly, there have been a couple of indictments, but those are all peripheral. This is about other issues. This is the core question of what it is that a president should do when we're talking about elections and about the transfer of power from one president to another.
It's the third indictment for Trump filed since March. As you mentioned, there were these other indictments, but they were kind of peripheral, which sets the stage for a pretty bizarre 2024 presidential race. Through all his legal challenges, Trump remains the GOP frontrunner. Can he legally continue to run for president if he is convicted on any of these charges?
No. No, it can't. Actually, what's interesting about this, I realize there's the ability of an appeal, but I think what's going to happen is this, is that if you're indicted, and this is really the question, if you're indicted, can this stop it? The answer is no.
I've heard that other analysts have said that, you know, technically, if he can still run, but you're saying if he's convicted.
Well, yeah, I mean, no, he can absolutely run. I mean, see, this is the problem, and this is what makes this so difficult. This is all new ground. We have never seen this before. And I mean, if we fall back on this broader question of can a sitting president do what he has done, because we have never seen anything like this before, this is completely untested law. Nobody really knows what a president can or cannot do. Not really, because normally, and I've been a lawyer for 25 years, and both on the prosecution side and on the defense side of this. And what I can tell you is that we all lean into something called precedent. This idea of what has happened in the past will tell us and guide us into the future. Well, our problem that we have here is that you can have a statute, you can have an ordinance, you can have a constitutional amendment, you can have all sorts of things that tell you where you think you're supposed to go. But the problem is it's usually how the courts have handled it that tell you what it actually means. And in this case, it's never happened before.
Trump is due in a Washington, D.C. federal courtroom on Thursday. What are you expecting?
Well, in a case like this, and this is big picture now, my expectation is this is going to be pushed out past the election. It may not happen yet, but that's what I think is coming. I think what we're going to see is that I know that Jack Smith has already said he wants this to happen quickly. He wants to see results. But I think realistically, when you talk about how big this is, I think it's unlikely that we're going to see this before the election.
That's criminal defense lawyer and former CIA officer Jack Rice. He was speaking to my colleague Carol Van Dam from St. Paul, Minnesota. This week, VOA English to Africa service is celebrating our 60th anniversary. My colleague Heidi Adams had the privilege of interviewing Marlene Selvi, the first staff member to start working for the service back in January 1963.
I started on January 3rd, 1963. And one by one, we assembled and were so excited about starting programming to Africa. It was historic for VOA to do something that was broadcasting mostly African news from one part of the continent to another. We'd never done this before any place. And it was all because Africa was vast, was becoming independent. By 1963, there were 28 independent countries. 17 of them became independent in 1960 alone. We called it the Year of Independence. And there were opportunities for the United States to get involved with Africa in ways that we certainly could not when the countries were controlled by England, France, and Portuguese. We wanted to be involved. Certainly there were economic reasons, but we wanted to be involved in principle to be helpful.
That was a founding member of the VOA English to Africa team, Marlene Selvi. She was speaking with VOA's Heidi Adams. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Nicole Peters, and our engineer, Jumbe Hamza, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.